Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity, set up chores, and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
I'm Greg Oliar. 4 years ago, I stopped writing novels to report on the crimes of Donald Trump and his associates. In 2018, I wrote a best-selling book about it, Dirty Rubles. In 2019, I launched Prevail, a biweekly column about Trump and Putin, spies and mobsters, and so many traitors! Trump may be gone, but the damage he wrought will take years to fully understand. Join me and a revolving crew of contributors and guests as we try to make sense of it all. This is Prevail.
Thanks to Noom for supporting Miller, She Wrote. Getting in shape isn't about a number on the scale, and Noom helps you develop new relationships with food, build healthier habits, and feel better about yourself. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com/AG. And thanks to Noemi for supporting Miller, She Wrote. Noemi designs and manufactures everything in-house and sells directly to consumers with a lifetime warranty and free shipping. Go to HelloNoemi.com/AG to get $50 off your first purchase with promo code AG. And thanks to Third Love for supporting Miller, She Wrote. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone, so right now they're offering our listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/AG to find yours today.
This is Jack Bryan, the co-writer and director of Active Measures, and you are listening to Miller, She Wrote. Lucky you.
So to be clear, Mr. Trump has no financial relationships with any Russian oligarchs.
That's what he said. That's what I said. That's obviously what our position is.
I'm not aware of any of those activities. I have been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I did not have communications with the Russians.
What do I have to get involved with Putin for? I have nothing to do with Putin. I've never spoken to him. I don't know anything about him other than he will respect me. Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing.
So, it is political. You're a communist.
No, Mr. Green. Communism is just a red herring. Like all members of the oldest profession, I'm a capitalist.
Hello, and welcome to Mueller, She Wrote. I'm your host, AG, and with me today is no one.
Just you and I. Sharing our love together.
All by myself.
Yes, that is right. Mandy is celebrating her birthday in London, and Jordan is taking a day off today. I am here, and I'm going to bring you the news, and we have a big show for you today with all your favorites. I'm AG, obviously, and we do have an interview about the trustworthiness of the Southern District of New York and Lev Parnas with real-life lawyer and host of the Opening Arguments podcast, Andrew Torres. So I'm really looking forward to that. We do have a lot of news to cram in, but first, we have some corrections.
It's a mistake. It's hard for me to say I'm sorry.
Oh, I made a mistake.
Okay, so from Crystal Danecki, I believe that's how that's pronounced. Let me know if it's not. Martha Stewart wasn't convicted for insider trading. She was convicted of making false statements to federal investigators and obstructing an agency proceeding. This is an excellent example of how someone can crime by impeding an investigation, even if it's never proven that they did the thing they were originally being investigated for. On the other hand, I've always suspected that someone chose to make an example of Ms. Stewart in particular because she's a successful woman. As we all know, that was Comey. He wrote about it in his book, A Higher Loyalty, and said, if I didn't go after her, then I wouldn't be applying the law equally to everyone. But that's an interesting theory. Another correction from Kate McCullough, former FBI. She says, this isn't necessarily a correction because you glossed over the comments pretty quickly, but I heard twice, Tuesday and Thursday, regarding FBI investigating Burisma and the hack by the GRU. She says, I doubt the FBI would investigate without Ukraine asking. It's completely out of U.S. jurisdiction. It is a Ukrainian company hacked by a foreign intelligence service. Maybe NSA or CIA would have interest in methods, but from my limited experience, I don't see how the FBI would have authority to proactively investigate. And that's a really good point, Kate. What I was thinking was that the FBI was investigating a foreign government interfering in our elections, and that might be part of that investigation. So, but you know, you're right. This is Russia hacking Burisma in Ukraine, and so unless the FBI were looking into that being somehow connected to Trump or the Trump campaign or other interests in the United States, I don't think the FBI would be out there doing it on their own. Although we did get a story from the New York Times, I think last month, saying that they were wouldn't say they were officially investigating, Russia interfering in our 2020 elections, but that could be part of it. And then from Jose Pineda on Daily Beans, one of you mentioned the oldest millennial was 35. As a 37-year-old person, I felt compelled to tell you that according to the bastion of truth that is Wikipedia, a reference that proves I am a millennial, millennials are the cohort born between 1981 to 1996, generally reaching adulthood in the early 21st century. All right, well, thank you for that. And then Jeff Nathan says, using the no-fly list as a means to prevent gun ownership is an awful idea, one rejected by the ACLU. And then they have a couple of links here. It's plagued with inaccuracies and common names. Worse, it's a list of people too dangerous to fly under any circumstances, but too innocuous to be arrested. And while I agree with that, I think what I want to say is that if they fix the no-fly list, I know it's got problems with it, then that might be something to use. I wouldn't say to use it as it is with all of its errors and mistakes that it currently has, as pointed out by the ACLU. But thank you for that correction. And Roan Katow says, in this past Sunday's episode, Mall Panafort, at 2032, you mentioned California State Senator John Morgan from Brentwood, who works for a cybersecurity firm called Area One. And Roan says, John Morgan is a state senator from New Hampshire, not California. Well, there, that is a legit correction. I thought Brentwood worked for Area One, which is based in California. I thought he was a Californian, but he is not. He is New Hampshire state senator. So thank you. And then Harvey Hurst says, on Tuesday, January 21st, AG mentioned again that Arizona didn't have an MLK holiday until 2006. But here's the timeline. In 1986, the holiday was declared by Governor Bruce Babbitt, a Democrat. And in 1987, the holiday was repealed by Governor Evan Meekum, Republican. That's, I think, the guy that was recalled and replaced by Rose Mofford. And then in 1992, Arizona voters reinstated the holiday by referendum. So that was it, 1992. There was a vote in 1990, but because there were two competing propositions, neither got enough votes. All right, those are corrections. Thank you for sending them in. If you have any corrections, please visit MuellerSheWrote.com, click Contact, select Corrections, and build us a compliment sandwich. We'll get it right eventually, I promise. And with corrections out of the way, let's get to the news with just the facts. Okay, so let's do a quick impeachment update for you. For more robust impeachment coverage, check out our sister podcast called The Daily Beans. It comes out early tomorrow morning, or if you're a patron of this podcast, you can get The Daily Beans ad-free and the night before it goes out to the public. So this week, the trial started in earnest. We know last week they signed the oath book and Chief Justice John Roberts was sworn in. But this is when they started the debate on the rules, and then the Dems took 21 of their 24 hours laying out the facts in a very impressive presentation that even Lindsey Graham and Matt Gaetz admitted was really well done. A lot of Republicans were like, hey, well done. I think Matt Gaetz actually said something like, that was so great, you know, and then the Trump's defense team looked like they were doing an eighth grade book report. And then he said, never mind, eighth graders probably know how to use iPads and PowerPoint. So interesting. So the Republicans did start their defense and that was Saturday. And they took only 2 hours of the eight, a little over two of the eight that they had available to them. Their defense was pretty weak. They brought up the Ukraine 2016 conspiracy theory that they hacked the elections and actually made a really good case for witnesses by repeating over and over that they haven't heard from firsthand witnesses. That makes the case for witnesses and documents, even if you don't believe the House manager's facts. Although a lot of Republican senators have said, look, it's not so much that we don't want witnesses or a fair trial. It's that we have to consider what the House sent us, and they didn't do their job by going through the courts to get all these subpoenas for witnesses and testimony. They should have done that. And, you know, they compare it to the Clinton trial. But of course, Clinton, they had over a year of a Ken Starr investigation with all the depositions and everything. And in this case, As you know, Pelosi and the House managers are like, look, it was, and it was urgent. It was an emergency to get this done, because if we had litigated this, if we had let the subpoena for Kupperman go through, if we'd subpoenaed Bolton and Mulvaney, it would have gone through the courts. It would have been delayed, and it probably would have gone past this election. And that is not good, because, you know, as you know, he, you know, Trump will cheat in this election. But that sort of was my whole point about holding the articles, because I don't think impeaching him and acquitting him is going to stop him from cheating. But, you know, again, I've always, not always, but I have learned Nancy has a plan, and we'll see how this works out. And also, running in parallel to the impeachment is the real world, where evidence keeps coming out implicating the president, including the breaking news this weekend that an audio tape exists of Trump telling Parnas and a small group, including Fruman and Jr., at a dinner in April of 2018 at the Trump D.C. hotel downtown to get rid of Yovanovitch. CBS released the audio, and we clearly hear Trump saying, get rid of her, get her out tomorrow, okay, do it. And we have that audio. We play it on the Daily Beans, and for more conversation about that tape and some of the other things said during that meeting, that the House had on audio that carries massive implications for the Trump administration, you can stick around for the interview today with Andrew Torres. We're going to talk about that. Also in impeachment news, Mike Pompeo has come out saying he is willing to testify if legally required, which means he knows he won't be legally required because he's a chicken shit. And he's made that clear in his embarrassing performance in an NPR interview with Mary Louise Kelly, in which he refuses to answer Ukraine questions, then afterwards yells at her for as long as the interview took, saying, do you think Americans give a fuck about Ukraine? And then asking her if she can point out Ukraine on a map, and then had a blank gotcha map ready to go. And then she did point it out, and then he snatched it away and said, people will hear about this. And then he left. So that was all on the record. So NPR released the story about the coda to that interview, and Pompeo made an official statement in response, accusing Mary Louise Kelly of lying to him twice because she said she wouldn't ask about Ukraine and because she thought the Post interview was off the record. Neither of those things are true. He then called the media unhinged and said, well, implied she was unable to point out Ukraine on the map, saying, you know, oh, Bangladesh is not Ukraine. And I think he's actually confusing Bangladesh with Budapest. But that, you know, either way, he admitted he carries blank maps around with him like a fucking weirdo. That's just astounding to me. Secretary of State. That's your Secretary of State. Anyhow, Pompeo would not agree to testify, I don't think, if he actually had to, which makes me think the administration is certain there will be no vote for witnesses, or a couple, not enough, not a majority. Though new polling shows 72% of Americans want witnesses and documents, including 69% of Republicans. So they may vote no for witnesses, but I think they'll pay the price in 2020. And then next in the news, the Justice Department is conceding that it had insufficient cause to continue to monitor Carter Page, Hat Boy. According to records made public late Thursday, the Department of Justice told the court that two of the four FISA applications for renewal for Carter Page had insufficient predication to establish probable cause. Now, is anyone surprised that Bill Barr is telling the courts, in opposition to the Inspector General's findings, that they did not have enough evidence to surveil Carter Page? First, nothing grabbed from the surveillance of Page was used in or to open any other investigations into Trump or Russia. Second, Carter Page wasn't charged with anything. The warrants were issued in September of 2016. Crossfire Hurricane was opened in earnest months earlier based on the Papadopoulos drunk brag. And third, nobody gives a shit about Carter Page, yet this Department of Justice keeps trying to make this FISA thing the entire crux of their defense that Russia didn't hack the elections and Mueller was appointed improperly, despite the multiple convictions Mueller got and every single federal judge that found Mueller's appointment authorized. And so it's just kind of, you know, everyone's pointing to this. All the conservatives and Trumpers are like, oh, look, the Department of Justice itself is saying, it didn't have enough. It didn't have predicate to get these FISA warrants. And, you know, yes, there were mistakes made with the FISA warrants, but again, nothing from Carter Page was used. Carter Page was not with the Trump campaign while he was being surveilled. It's just the weirdest defense to hang your hat on, so to speak, your Carter Page hat, your floppy Padres free hat night hat. Also in the news, last December, Congress passed a defense bill, National Defense Authorization Act, which included a provision ordering the DNI, or Director of National Intelligence, to provide Congress an unclassified report identifying those responsible for the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And that was in the Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul in 2018, as we know. That deadline passed last week, and nothing from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and that's in violation of the National Defense Authorization Act. That's against the law. And as we know, the CIA has concluded Mohammed Bonsaw, or Mohammed bin Salman, ordered the killing. Ron Wyden, a senator, has written to Joseph McGuire, that's the DNI, saying, "Our office has asked the ODNI, that's the Office of the DNI, about the status of that information and has not received a response." So that's really interesting. And according to BuzzFeed, the provision in the NDAA required conclusions and evidence about the advanced knowledge and role of any current or former official of the government of Saudi Arabia or any current or former senior Saudi political figure over the directing, ordering, or tampering of evidence, and it asked for a list of foreigners that were responsible for or complicit in ordering, controlling, or otherwise directing an act or acts contributing to or causing Khashoggi's death, as well as anyone who impeded the impartial investigation of his killing. So all that sort of going on behind the scenes while this impeachment trial is headed towards now Monday. I think we're going to have a full or a close to a full 8-hour presentation by Trump's legal team, and also on Tuesday. And then Wednesday and Thursday, maybe Friday, I expect to do the questions by senators. I think it's a 16-hour block. Then there will be a 4-hour debate and then a vote up or down on whether witnesses will happen. Romney has said he's likely to vote for witnesses, but as you know, we need 4 Republican senators to break ranks and vote for them. And of course, Murkowski and Collins are just shocked by what they heard Adam Schiff say when he reported something that came out from CBS News. That someone had heard, an unnamed source had heard Trump threaten senators, saying he would put their heads on pikes if they voted against him. And now they're saying, well, that just makes me so angry that you would say that, that I'm going to shit all over the Constitution now because I'm mad you hurt my feelings. So yes, feelings are real. Yes, people have feelings, but I don't think that that's a reason to not take your oath to the Constitution or your job as a senator seriously. I think, but honestly, I think they were looking for any way out to be able to convince their constituents that they shouldn't vote for witnesses. I'm surprised they used that as an excuse. We'll be right back with Hot Notes and the Fantasy Indictment League, so stay with us. Hey everybody, it's AG, and this episode of Mueller, She Wrote is brought to you by Noom. Getting in shape doesn't have to be about losing weight or a magic number on the scale. It's about building healthier habits and feeling better. I'm fitting into that favorite pair of jeans. Maybe that's your goal, maybe not, maybe more energy is, but there's many reasons you might want to practice self-care, and every person is different. That's why I love this new habit change program from Noom. Noom adjusts to your lifestyle. They teach you the psychology behind the decisions you make that might throw up obstacles and help you keep track of everything from workouts and steps to analyzing your diet and a great food log and recommending healthy recipes. And it's all right in one app. I used to have 5 different apps to do all those things, and now it's all in the Noom app. Noom also connects you with a personally assigned goal specialist and a community of other Noomers, so you have all the support you need to empower your change. I basically started this a year ago. I wanted more energy. The initial thing was that I lost 17 pounds. That's cool. I've been able to keep it off with Noom because you pick the goals that are right for you, and Noom personalizes the program to help your goals become reality. It's based on a cognitive behavioral approach, and it uses personalized courses to help you reach your specific goals. You don't have to commit to a rigorous plan either. It's just 10 minutes a day, and they make it really convenient with the Noom app. Noom doesn't tell you what to do and what not to do. It teaches you how to look inside your own mind and make better decisions for yourself. And if you go off track, there's no guilt, there's no shaming, just tips to help you get back on track tomorrow. It's a perfect time to make a step towards healthier habits. Sign up for your trial today at Noom, Noom.com/AG. What do you have to lose? Visit Noom.com/AG to start your trial today. That's Noom, Noom.com/AG. All right, welcome back. Hot Notes. First of all, there was a story that came out about a month ago from Forensic News Net, our friend Scott Stedman. and that it was about, you know, possible Trump getting loans from a subsidiary of Deutsche Bank called, I think, DBTCA. And they have, and as soon as they put that story out with their whistleblower, Val Bruksmidt, they had a DDoS attack on their site. It was shut down, and they were threatened to be sued and all that. And now, just recently, this month, this week, they put out another story. They have now documents showing that a Russian bank, VEB, Veneshkonom Bank, put $500 million into DBTCA while DBTCA was lending to Trump. There are no direct connections yet, but I would really highly recommend you go to ForensicNewsNet and check out this story. As soon as they posted it, they were under DDoS attack again. Somebody's very angry about this. VEB is one of our top choices for the mystery company from Country A, which we haven't heard anything about since June. That was the last reporting that we got from that court case. That, of course, is when Mueller subpoenaed, under seal this financial institution wholly owned by a foreign government that does considerable business in the United States. They were being held in contempt for $50,000 a day. I know you remember all that from last year, if you've been listening to Mueller, She Wrote, for a while. And so I don't know if that's connected to this, or if that's something that Mueller was looking into and then stopped and handed off, because we know Rod Rosenstein was in charge of telling Mueller what he had to hand off. And just a real quick thing about Mueller before I get into my hot note, my full-on hot note here. A lot of people are still Mueller, saying Mueller is a coward. He didn't come out and say enough. Why didn't he come out and call Trump to the, to the carpet or whatever? Is that a thing? Calling people to the carpet? I don't know. And here's the answer. I've said this a million times till I was blue in the face. But first of all, it was Rod Rosenstein who directed what he could and couldn't investigate. He created the scope. He created the scope memos, and then he had to have permission along the way, and had cases handed off. We know Mueller didn't look into the finances. He didn't follow the money. He also didn't check to see if the vote count was altered or not, based on Russian interference. And the most important thing, the reason Mueller didn't come out and say Trump, I can't indict him, but he definitely committed obstruction of justice, is because if he did that, he knows that Trump could be prosecuted after he leaves office as a civilian if we vote him out this time, because the statute of limitations is 5 years. And if he had come out and said Trump's a criminal, but I'm not charging him, first of all, he said constitutionally that's not fair because Trump doesn't get a trial in which to defend himself and confront his accuser. But second of all, it could taint any future prosecution. So if imagine Mueller came out and said Trump, he committed obstruction of justice, and then Trump leaves office, and then somebody in the Southern District of New York or the new U.S. Attorney General wants to go after Trump for obstruction of justice, Trump has a really great argument. Hey, I can't, this is not going to be a fair trial because I had special counsel Mueller come out and call me a criminal. No jury is going to give me a fair trial. The whole thing is tainted. And even if they did go through a trial, they would be able to call a mistrial pretty easily. And so that is why he did not. That is why Mueller was like so adamant. Yes, you can prosecute him when he leaves office. Yes. Yes, you can. And no, I'm not going to say he's a criminal because then you can't. So I just want everyone to sort of understand that. I know people are angry that Mueller didn't, come out more forcefully, but there are reasons for that. And I just wanted to get that off my chest. And speaking of Trump and Russian banks, we know that the Mueller memos are coming out in batches every month in the BuzzFeed and CNN FOIA cases. But we have noted that a lot of those documents are heavily redacted. And just recently, BuzzFeed raised the issue that the Department of Justice was blocking the release of the Kushner FBI interview notes, known as 302s. I thought the 31-page redacted interview that was released January 3rd might have been the Kushner interview, but the Department of Justice is now responding, saying they're still reviewing the Kushner materials for redactions. A lawyer for the Department of Justice, Courtney Enlow, informed CNN that the Kush 302 will be released with the appropriate redactions as soon as the member of the intelligence community that's reviewing it is finished with their review to ensure that it's properly redacted. The Department of Justice did not say which intelligence agency was reviewing it or who the intelligence officer is that's reviewing it, or how long it would take. But currently, the Department of Justice is in violation of Judge Reggie Walton's order. And so here we have that constitutional crisis everybody's talking about, when there's a direct court order and the Department of Justice is failing to comply with it. And because Walton had ordered the Department of Justice to hand over the material to CNN and BuzzFeed as part of their FOIA suit by January 17th, including the Kushner 302. And in the meantime, I would like for any dispensary, if you're listening, to name a strain, Kush 302. I think it's a great name. The odd thing, back to the story here, is that there's been a lot of damning things coming out of the Mueller document dump. So it's clear why Kushner's would merit further delay. But it's not clear why it would merit scrutiny. And Judge Walton has warned the Department of Justice in the past that if the redacted things are not redacted appropriately, he would not hesitate to look behind each black bar to determine if the appropriateness of the redaction himself. He said, I'll go through it myself line by line to make sure these are appropriate. And according to Caitlin Polance at CNN, she's one of the folks in the FOIA suit, along with Jason Leopold at BuzzFeed, the FBI's been consulting with other agencies as it releases the 302s, and more documents are expected to be released in early February. And we don't know if the trial will be over by then. I know that Trump's goal is to have it done by February 3rd, 4th, the State of the Union address, and I don't know that we'll get another dump by then. I'm certain when they put out the Kushner interview, it'll be any of the good stuff will be redacted. But while this is happening, we, of course, have the Mueller grand jury material case that's working its way through the Supreme Court. And we expect a decision in the June-July timeframe on that. And don't forget, the Department of Justice and other agencies are also hard at work redacting and releasing Ukraine documents, also filed for in a court FOIA case, or multiple FOIA cases. The House is still investigating the Mueller obstruction of justice and is also awaiting the McGahn testimony, with a decision also due in the June-July timeframe. And it has said it has not ruled out additional articles of impeachment for obstruction of justice in the Mueller investigation, but it has to do its own investigation. It can't rely on the Mueller report. It has to do its own. Kushner was being looked at by Mueller for a multitude of reasons outside the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting knowledge that he had. Trying to think of why they would be delaying this and trying to redact it. He was also tied to the Qatar Investment Authority, the head of a Russian think tank who CNN doesn't name in their article. But if you listen to Mueller, she wrote, you know, it's Dmitry Symes, who showed up hundreds of times in the Mueller report, who may have been the handler for Maria Butina. We also know that Kushner companies and Russian individuals exchanged suspicious money transfers during the 2016 election, according to a former Deutsche Bank employee that spoke to the New York Times. That was a while back. We reported on that. And Kush also met with Russian banker Sergei Gorkov, the CEO of Veneshkonom Bank, or VEB. We mentioned that earlier, a sanctioned Russian bank. And of course, Kush met with Kislyak a few times during the campaign and during the transition. Kushner spoke to Mueller's team at least three times that we know of in 2017 and 2018. And there's a lot that could be hidden in his 302s. So some of that might be tied to open and ongoing or stalled investigations into Deutsche Bank or the secret company from Country A, as I mentioned earlier, or the bailout of the 666 Fifth Avenue Devil Building. The connections of Torsion, Symes, and Butina could be the Qatar Investment Authority's cut of the selling off of the Russian state-owned oil company. And there was supposed to be a 0.5% commission of about $280 million that's gone walkies. We don't know where that is. That could be in there. And what deals, if any, were made with VEB to potentially secure funding for property debt? And whatever it is, it seems very important. And I certainly hope Judge Walton will take a look at the redactions for appropriateness when BuzzFeed and CNN finally get those 302s. We haven't heard from Walton. If we do, I'll let you know. But this is probably as close as we're going to get to the Mueller material, because in the June-July SCOTUS decision on the grand jury stuff Nadler filed for last July 27th, that'll be kept secret because of the rules governing grand jury secrecy. Remember, we didn't get the Jaworski roadmap from the Nixon grand jury until 2018, so hats off to the Fourth Estate for their diligent work filing FOIA suits and getting this information out to the public. Alrighty, y'all ready for sabotage? Okay, a new court filing has revealed corruption at the very tippy top of the Trump inaugural. All this week, we've been discussing the charges brought against Zuberi in the Daily Beans podcast. And during our interview last week with Joyce Vance, we discussed the difference between an indictment and an information. And that's why this didn't count as an indictment for the Fantasy Indictment League, because it appears Zuberi is cooperating. At least that's the signal. This is in the Southern District of New York. And as a refresher, Zuberi is the only person that was named in the sweeping subpoena of the inaugural committee a year ago, last February. And now we think, and now this week in a new lawsuit brought by the D.C. Attorney General named Carl Racine, they show Rick Gates received a quote from the Trump D.C. hotel for $3.6 million for 8 days, $450,000 a day. And then Gates emailed Ivanka saying that's quite high compared to other property buyouts for the week. And he was worried about the optics of the inaugural paying a Trump hotel and paying them a high fee. Ivanka said, let me see what I can do. And then told Gates a few days later she had a new quote, just $175,000 a day, a rate that still far exceeds like properties in the area, though. And at that point, if you're a longtime listener, you'll remember this, as we've been on this story for years now, Melania's friend Wolkoff, that's Melania Trump's friend, who was given $26 million to organize the events, told Ivanka and Gates she was concerned about what would happen if they were audited. This will all come out when we're audited. So Racine is suing for a return of the money so it can be distributed to real nonprofits in D.C. and alleging that the inaugural broke the D.C. nonprofit rules. So that's sabotage for today. And with that, let's play the Fantasy Indictment League.
I'm going to be indicted!
No, wait, it's going to be okay.
Indicted!
Honey, Dick.
Indicted!
Honey,
I'm going to be indicted!
Hold it, they can't. It's going to be okay. Just calm down.
I can't calm down. I'm going to be indicted!
Okay, it's just me today, so I get all the picks. I am going to go with superseding Parnas and Giuliani, if the Southern District isn't corrupt. I'm also going to go with that guy who altered the FISA application email. I think his name's Klein Smith. I'm sure Barr will go after that guy. I'm going to go superseding Fruman. And then I'm also going to go with Michael Flynn, because I'm not sure if the prosecutors are happy with just his one charge now that he's withdrawn his guilty plea from last week. All right, we now have, coming up in a minute, right after this break, the interview with Andrew Torres from Opening Arguments. It's a great podcast. That is coming up next. We're going to discuss Parnas, so stick with us. Hey, everybody. This segment of Mueller, She Wrote is brought to you by Noemi. Anyone who's shopped for jewelry knows it can be insanely expensive, but Noemi believes that luxury jewelry doesn't have to be overpriced. They cut out the middleman to deliver exceptional, fine jewelry without the traditional retail markups. Noemi designs and manufactures everything in-house and sells directly to consumers with a lifetime warranty and free shipping both ways. You can save an average of 50% compared to other luxury brands. Authenticity is guaranteed with an IGI certificate detailing color, clarity, and appraisal value. You can personalize your jewelry with engravings or add order custom designs. But best of all, you can return any order for a full refund, even engravings and custom designs. They have no hassle returns and exchanges. It's literally an entirely risk-free experience. I ordered my friendship ring from Noemi. It came in beautiful packaging. It's such good quality. It's just absolutely beautiful. I love it. It's simple, the lines are gorgeous, and I saved so much money. And you can even use flexible payment options with no hidden costs and no extra charges. Read the thousands of five-star reviews on their website and see for yourself. So if you're looking for quality fine jewelry made to last a lifetime from a luxury brand you can trust, it's Noemi. They have thousands of five-star reviews online, and we suggest reading some and see why people are raving about this company. Go to hellonoemi.com/AG to see their collection and get $50 off your first purchase with promo code AG. That's HelloNoemi.com/AG. And don't forget to use promo code AG for $50 off your first purchase. Joining us today for the interview from the Opening Arguments podcast is real-life lawyer and real-life friend, Andrew Torres. Andrew, thanks for coming on Mueller, She Wrote.
Hey, G, thanks for having me. Love coming on the show.
It's been a while. How are you?
I am doing fantastically well, although, you know, like you, I'm pretty much mainlining caffeine because the events in the news keep changing every few seconds, so...
Yeah.
It's a scary time in which we live and have our jobs, but there you go. How are you?
I'm good. And I just wanted to give everybody a fair warning here. When Andrew and I talk, we tend to interrupt each other. It is no disrespect on either side. I just wanted you to be aware of it. We're going to do our best not to, but I just wanted to give y'all fair warning. Sometimes people, I can't believe she cut you off, Andrew, and I can't believe he cut you off, AG. And I wanted to let everybody know it's out of nothing but love.
It is the ultimate level of respect, because I know, at least on my end, I just can't wait to dive into what you're saying, because you always ask such fantastic questions and have such great points. So,
well, thank you. And I think we do honestly have a really good push and pull in a conversation. So
yeah.
Let's kick it off. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Southern District of New York. As you probably know, our listeners certainly know, we used to have a saying on this podcast, you know, because Martin Luther King Jr. used to say the arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And we said the arc of justice is long, but it bends towards the Southern District of New York. But ever since Barr took over in February of last year, and the Cohen case was shut down, and we haven't heard anything about any of the referred Mueller cases, Giuliani hasn't been arrested, and that Lev and Igor might have actually been set up by Berman and Barr with the help of Hannity and Giuliani. I feel like Americans are losing faith in the Southern District, if not the Department of Justice in general. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on the Southern District these days. And do you think Barr should recuse himself from the Lev and Igor case, as Lev Parnas and his lawyer have requested?
Yeah, wow. So there's a lot in that. Let's try and unpack it. And I mean, as I think you know, right, I tend to trust in our in. I don't like conspiracy theories, right? And I do want to say at the outset, right, we have zero evidence that Jeffrey Berman, right, the current U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, that he's compromised in any way, right? He prosecuted Michael Cohen. He prosecuted Natasha Valmetskaya. He indicted, Parnas and Furman, right? So I don't think there's, I wouldn't make that argument.
And I think recently he's entering into an agreement or did an information charge on Zuberi from the inaugural. That was him too, I believe.
Yep. So look, I don't think Berman is a hack, right? I don't think Berman is compromised. I do think there are a number of things that make it easy for Bill Barr to put his thumb on the scale. And let's take a step back. I mean, to me, you know, kind of what the fundamental story that I don't understand why it's not being covered, and part of it is because this is one of my most spectacularly failed predictions, but I predicted in April of 2018 that Bill Barr would be impeached by May of 2018, right? I mean, here is somebody who essentially released a, quote, summary of the Mueller report that, in essence, omitted the word not in multiple places, right? I mean, this is just something that is, unconscionable and beyond the pale. And, that seems to have, like, washed over everybody as the Attorney General has morphed the job of the nation's top law enforcement official and representative of the United States of America into the personal representative of Donald Trump. And look, like, I can't stress highly enough. Look, let's put it this way. You well know, right? If you're an executive branch employee, there are 38 separate laws that are meant to apply to your conduct, right? You get that in your employee handbook manual. And those are things, they range from give you one example, right? 5 U.S.C. 7351 is the statute that makes it illegal for you to give a gift to an official superior, right? You can't, like, participate in a, Christmas exchange, holiday, like, I'm going to give you a $5 gift. Like, that is prohibited by federal law. Right? And interacting with all of that is 18 U.S.C. 205, which prohibits any government employee or any U.S. attorney, other than in the proper discharge of their duties, from acting as an agent for anyone before any department in connection with any matter in which the United States is a party or has a direct and substantial interest, right? So put all that together. I know I'm being verbose here.
No. We do have all these rules. Like, you know, and if I worked for a contractor and then I work for the government, I can't have anything to do with that contractor for 2 years, and I can't have work on, if they use them as a contractor, I can't be a part of that. I have to recuse myself from it.
I really love that you brought that up, right? Because these laws, right, are meant to overlap, right? And by that, I mean one instance of conduct might violate 5 or 6 different statutes, because that's an indication where when you're brainstorming as the Congress and you're like, look, what do we want to do? We want to broadly make it such that if you work in the executive branch, you're not trying to do the bidding of anybody other than the government, right? Mm-hmm. We want nothing that would corrupt the government's decision-making process. And that phrase, by the way, comes directly from the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, right? Corrupt the government's decision-making process. And so, as you point out, right, these statutes go beyond just formal legal conflicts, right? Like, it's also a conflict of interest if a federal employee shows up at an uncontested hearing, right? Like, let's say a patent application, right? Like, you apply for a patent. That's not an adversarial process. There's no, but if an executive branch employee shows up and says, hey, I really think you ought to approve, you know, USPTO, you really ought to approve this patent. That's a felony. Okay. So put all of that together. William Barr's conduct since assuming the office of Attorney General has been felonious. Okay, has been in violation of multiple laws. And by the way, these laws get litigated fairly frequently, right? Like, there are nearly 100 cases that litigate the Section 205 that I just described. So put all of that together. It is beyond inappropriate that Bill Barr is involved in the things in which Bill Barr is involved, right? That he intercepted the ICIG report and, you know, tried to statutorily put the kibosh on transmittal of the whistleblower complaint to Congress, right? It's spectacularly ridiculous that he is the person that Donald Trump mentions on the July 25th call with Zelensky. This is a scandal, and I want people to be more outraged over that.
Well, we can take this all the way back to the Mueller report, can't we? Because he's a Kirkland, and he's a former Kirkland and Ellis guy, I believe, which represented Alpha Bank at some point, and he shouldn't have had his hands anywhere near the Mueller investigation, the Mueller report, any of it. But for that alone, I'm sure there are many other conflicts of interest. Certainly more conflicted than, let's say, Mueller was for not paying a golf fee at Doral or whatever the fuck. I mean, you know,
I, as I've said on my show before, it is astonishing to me that you and I are nostalgic for the heady days of the ethics of Jeff Sessions. But like, literally, that's where we are, right? Those were the depths below which we thought we could not sink, and now here we are. So, okay, I think that's a pretty strong case about what Bill Barr is doing. And then the question is, could he put his thumb on the scale? And the answer to that is, that's trivially easy for him to do. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's easy in a number of ways, right? Because there is such a real thing as prosecutorial discretion, but some prosecutions, I can't go through the list of all the statutes, but some specifically require the Attorney General to sign off. And even those that don't, right, there's this culture of communication inside the DOJ, right? I don't know anybody at the Southern District. I just want to make that clear. But I know lots of people who have been AUSAs, and I know 6 of the past U.S. attorneys in the District of Maryland, right? And the way in which decisions get made is collaborative, right? It is you sit around and you talk and you run that up the chain, And so,
yeah, I mean, we've all watched Billions, right? I mean, that's how it works.
Yeah.
I wish Paul Giamatti was the Attorney General right now.
Oh gosh, I wish Paul Giamatti from the end of Sideways was the Attorney General. Right?
That would
right?
be great.
So number one, you kind of have this culture of communication. Number two, you have a real push and pull. And again, I don't want to impugn anybody, right? Because if you're a good and faithful public servant, it must be hard to work on, you know, in an executive branch agency under Trump. But it's not the right answer to just say, oh, well, you know, you should quit and resign, right? Number one, that means you're no longer, right? Like, that would leave only sycophants and losers, right? Like, there is a virtue to continuing to do your job inside an executive branch agency. And also,
it's weird though, because like Jesse Liu, who is a U.S. attorney, right? She, I was talking to Joyce Vance about the McCabe decision, and I was like, well, if she decides to go ahead with an indictment of McCabe despite the grand jury balking on it, that seems she would be compromised. But would she resign or would she stay in place to sort of shield her office? And Joyce was of the mind, you have to resign or you're corrupt. So it's kind of this hard line that you have to walk to. Like you said, if you leave, you're leaving all, only yes men and sycophants. But if you don't, you're corrupt.
Yeah, I don't mean to suggest by that there, you know, that there is no line, right? Like I was just following orders, right? Like I 100% agree with Joyce Vance on that. All I'm saying is that heading up, that I think she's accurately described sort of where the line is, right? Which is why I believe, right, if you had an unambiguous recommendation, let's say, right, Jeffrey Berman, again, Jeffrey Berman has a history with Rudy Giuliani, but if Berman sent up an unambiguous recommendation of here's why we want to indict Giuliani and was then told no, right, we're not going to do that, and then as it was revealed, you know, the legal justifications for that were transparent, then yes, he's got to resign. I agree with that. So,
yeah.
But I don't, right, these are all, what makes this difficult is that we're trying to anticipate in the absence of evidence, right, what's going on in the background. And a lot of these are judgment calls, right? And so it makes it harder even on you as an individual to sort of say like, okay, well, you know, have I hit that red line yet? And remember, on top of all of that, like the precedent is such that if you're a U.S. attorney, like you can be fired at any time, right? And you can be fired for political purposes with zero repercussions, right? Like you and I both remember the Monica Goodling back in 2006, December 2006, I think. That, you know, compiled the spreadsheet of political activities of, you know, a half dozen U.S. attorneys who George W. Bush then fired. So it's a tough, all I'm saying is that's a tough balance. There's sort of two more components of the question. Barr should recuse himself, but he won't. No reason to think that he will. He's just completely corrupted the office. And then, you know, sort of the implicit question of, well.
All right. So basically what you're saying is it's not as black and white as either Berman will either resign or indict Rudy. There's shades of gray in there. And I do want to talk to you a little bit about Lev Parnas and what he's coming forward with and some of the amazing things that Chuck Rosenberg asked him on Matto on Friday night. We'll be right back with more from Andrew Torres. So stay with us. Hey everybody, it's AG. This episode of Mueller, She Wrote is brought to you by my new favorite woman-owned company, Third Love. I am obsessed with their bras. They design the most comfortable bras you've ever worn, tailored to perfectly fit your individual body shape. I was able to find my perfect fit in just a minute by taking their online fit finder quiz. They use your info plus metadata from millions of women who have taken the quiz, and they take into account cup size and breast shape to find the perfect bra for you. Many women fall in between cup sizes, including myself, making it really difficult to find the perfect fit because you either get cup gap or spillage. But Third Love has over 80 bra sizes, industry leader, including their signature half cup sizes, so I was able to find the perfect fit for me. Every bra from Third Love is made with the ultimate comfort in mind, from their memory foam cups to no-slip straps, smooth, scratch-free bands, and a printed label on the bra so there's no itchy label. It's all designed for optimal comfort. Their team of expert fit stylists are dedicated to helping you find your perfect fit, and they're available to help via chat or email. And Third Love backs every bra with their perfect fit promise. And this is the philanthropy that I love. You have 60 days to wash it and wear it. And if it's not the perfect fit for you, returns are always free. And then they donate all of their gently used bras to people in need. And so far, Third Love has donated over $15 million in bras. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone, so right now they're offering our listeners 15% off your first order. So go to thirdlove.com/AG now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/AG for 15% off today. All right, we're back with Andrew Torres from the Opening Arguments podcast. And Andrew, you had mentioned before the break that you had predicted in April of 2018 that Barr would be impeached. And that is... Oddly,
sorry, thanks for reminding everyone of that. That is
oddly the same month that Parnas and Junior and Igor and Trump had their clandestine meeting at the Trump downtown D.C. hotel, of which we've heard the audio now. And interestingly, Chuck Rosenberg, Maya Wiley, and Claire McCaskill, former Senator Claire McCaskill, who was awesome, joined Matto on Friday night to talk about this. And Chuck Rosenberg had some interesting questions for Parnas's lawyer, Joseph Bondi, regarding the Southern District. First, he asked if they had permission from the Southern District to insist in the impeachment. And Bondi said no. But they did get permission to travel so that Parnas could be on Matto and Cooper, Anderson Cooper. What really happened was a judge had signed off that he could release his information to the House Intelligence Committee. So I thought that was a very interesting question from Chuck Rosenberg, formerly, I think, of the Southern District, and asking if he had permission as an indicted person. So what do you think about that? I mean, I don't know if they sought permission and were told no, or if they just went and got a judge to sign off on it. Is that something, do you think, happens a lot?
So here's the dynamic that often happens with witnesses like Parnas, right? And the first thing to understand as background is, right, we know Parnas was arrested on October 9th. He was charged with four specific felonies. He's pled not guilty to that, right? That scheme, we could talk about it or not. It's not super relevant, but that scheme involved Ukrainian official corrupting elections in Nevada, right? And so he's charged with two counts of conspiracy to violate the election laws, one count of making false statements to the Federal Elections Commission, and one count of falsification of records. And Parnas says he's not guilty of that specific crime. However, one of the things that he's angling for, I'm sure you're going to ask about this, is some kind of either downward departure or downward variance from the sentencing guidelines. The way in which you get a departure in these kinds of circumstances is under Section 5K1.1, which I know you've heard of, from the sentencing guidelines, in which a witness offers substantial assistance to authorities in the prosecution of another person who has committed an offense.
I know exactly where you're going with this, because I know that Parnas and Bondi, his lawyer, are saying that the Southern District wouldn't talk to him, but he is assisting in the impeachment of Donald Trump. Now, would that fall under that, since impeachment is not a criminal proceeding, but it is a judicial proceeding? It's a political process?
So it will not surprise you that there is zero case law as to whether assisting in an impeachment qualifies for a 5K 1.1 motion. But there are two things to think about in connection with that, right? The first is, at the end of the day, the sentencing guidelines themselves have been advisory for the past 15 years, right, since the Supreme Court's decision in the Booker and Fanfan cases, right? And so although the sentencing guidelines are the presumptive structure that applies, ultimately, the question of whether you are going to depart from the sentencing guidelines or issue a sentence that is at variance with what the guidelines would say is really an issue of a memo that the sentencing judge writes, right? And then there's a question of how that gets reviewed on appeal, that sort of thing. So even if under a technical application, 5K1.1 wouldn't apply to an impeachment, I think it would, by the way, to give you a concrete answer. But even if it wouldn't, you can still depart for other reasons. But the second thing that's really worth knowing that I think explains a lot of the dynamic here is that has to do with the balance of power between the prosecutor and the defendant, right? Every defendant, right, once they're charged and they're looking at a pretty significant amount of prison time on the sentencing guidelines table, then says, okay, well, now I want to cooperate, right? And every prosecutor knows that, right? And so the leverage there is, okay, well, and this is typically what a prosecutor would say is, okay, well, you, great. Help us as much as you can, answer all our questions, do what we said, and then we'll evaluate that at the end and tell you whether that is, quote, substantial assistance or not. Mm-hmm. And there are hundreds, maybe thousands of cases, I know of at least hundreds, in which a defendant has rendered assistance in the prosecution of someone else. But at the end of the day, the prosecutor's office will say, yeah, you definitely assisted us. You definitely helped us. We don't think that was substantial. And so...
Oh, yeah, it happened with Berman and Cohen.
Yep, exactly right. Right. So so that dynamic is something that prosecutors are sort of very acutely aware of. And when you think you have somebody who's a bad guy, and look, Parnas is a bad, bad dude, right? And so you've got somebody that you think is a bad guy. They're saying, I want to offer assistance. You're like, yeah, right, I get it. Everybody wants to offer assistance. Go ahead, do what you can, and then we'll judge afterwards. We're not going to make any commitments right now that says we definitely think X or Y or Z counts as substantive assistance. That's how these kinds of cases get prosecuted.
Yeah. And Bondi actually did say, because Rosenberg asked him, Rosenberg says, because of the sentencing,
oh, these were so good.
Because of the sentencing guidelines, Parnas doesn't really need help in reducing his sentence here, but it's nice to have a cooperative record of sentencing. And he asks Joseph Bondi if Parnas is helping with the impeachment for that favorable look. And Bondi says, yes. And while, you know, like you just said, we haven't seen any, assistance in impeachment, we have seen witnesses get downward variance or downward departure for assisting Congress. And who knows, he says, the Southern District might actually at some point ask for a Parnas cooperation. But so far they have not. And they also have not asked him to stop talking to Congress or the public. So there's that. But I mean, the other thing here is that Rosenberg said to Bondi, and this was really interesting. He says there's three reasons that the Southern District would not seek a cooperation agreement. Either it's because you're not credible, they don't need your cooperation, or because there's something else going on. And to that, Joseph Bondi replies, well, there's something else going on, insinuating something there's something nefarious in the Southern District. And I don't know Bondi from a hole in the ground, And, you know, Parnas is, like you said, he's a criminal. But, like, I just can't figure out what it is and what's going on.
So here's my best guess on that. And by the way, and again, I was going to say no disrespect to Bondi, but some disrespect to Bondi. the statement about because of the sentencing guidelines, Parnas doesn't really need that. Like, that's nonsense. Okay. I did a quick look, and part of the way in which you can get away with that is because the sentencing guidelines are like 900 pages long, and you have to flip between these various sections, and it's super complicated. But basically, like, what you do is...
That was Rosenberg that said that, not Bondi. Rosenberg was like, you don't really need downward departure because, I mean, the sentencing guidelines aren't that bad for the, you know, what he's done.
But I've heard, okay, I didn't realize it in connection with that, but I've heard Bondi make that argument, and that is part of, you know, sort of the background of the discussion on this. When I look at the most serious offense, right, which are the two conspiracy to commit election fraud offenses, I get, under a maximum calculation, an offense level of 19, right? And look, like, I agree in comparison to, and an offense level of 19 is 30 to 37 months. That's 3 years in jail. And it's in Zone D. That means you basically serve all of it. You don't get any split sentences. You don't get probation, right? And the difference between 3 years in jail and moving that down to a 16, which would be 2 years in jail, or moving it down to a 13, which would be a split sentence and maybe less than a year in jail, to me, that's pretty significant. And so, you know, I don't agree with the premise of that in terms of that there isn't a reason to want to put yourself in the position of, you know, a Rick Gates, right? Like, and factually, right, the structure, like, okay, remember all of those 0 to 6 sentences, right? Like, we're gonna say, I know we don't have time to go down the Michael Flynn rabbit trail, but, like, you know, we're gonna look at all, like, the reason those folks were in the 0 to 6 category is because they were charged with a single count of making a false statement, right? And that, and again, Parnas has that count as well, but Parnas has 3 other counts that are pretty significant. And so, you know, so I don't necessarily agree with the premise of that question. I think there is real incentive to make sure that you don't piss off the prosecutor.
So he could really use that downward departure. And then what do you think about the Joseph Bondi alleging that there's something rotten in Denmark, a.k.a. Southern District of New York? Because, I mean, he's saying, hey, my witness was credible. And to be fair, the audio tape backs up what he told Maddow. The text messages and the documents and the emails back up what he's saying. Sort of nothing's sort of been disproven in this sort of weird sort of like a amoeba of a almost like a Steele dossier situation, you know. But I mean, he's still, you know... The allegation that there's something fishy going on at the Southern District really just sort of, I just don't know what to make of it.
Yeah, it doesn't sit well with me either, right? Going back to the beginning of this interview. If you're Bondi, you can't say what I am about to say, which is, Lev Parnas is a terrible witness.
My client is awful.
No one would ever put him on the stand. But here's the thing, and I'm really glad you phrased the question the way you did, because I get pushback on my show for this all the time. Right, I've been saying this ever since the Parnas stuff broke. A bad witness can nevertheless be telling the truth about 95% of what they're talking about. Right. And let's put this into context. In the first Paul Manafort trial, right, in which the jury failed to convict on basically half of the counts, most of the subsequent juror interviews have basically said, like, yeah, literally, we just didn't think Gates was a good witness. Right. Like, we just weren't sure we believed everything he was saying. It just kind of seemed like he was trying to curry favor and, you know, whatever.
It was the documentary evidence that got them to convict.
Yeah. And so, right, so I am super sympathetic to the counterargument that I have gotten from other lawyers on my show, which is, yeah, when you're a prosecutor and you're busting a criminal conspiracy, the people who are your witnesses are also going to be criminals. That's certainly true, right? Boy Scouts don't participate in stuff like this.
Yeah, I know. I've been saying, well, find me a non-crimey guy from the Trump that associates with Trump that you would trust, like that you would listen to. Please, I'll wait here with Sammy the Bull, and you find me someone. And you know, you're right, because we, you know, we can, he I think his 95% of the stuff that he's saying, which is backed up by his text and documentary evidence and the tape, is true. But then you have this, no, we were just joking around about, you know, putting surveillance on Yovanovitch. I think they friggin' put a hit out on her. I don't know what's going on with this Belgian guy, but that's not real. There's something else going on there. We were just drunk for a whole week and joking around. No,
that can happen in Ukraine. I have a Ukrainian friend, and that strikes me as not implausible. But yeah, look, at the end of the day, and again, I mean, you know this, but just so your listeners know, right? Like, I'm a civil litigator, right? Not a prosecutor, but I go through, as part of my job as a trial lawyer, this experience of asking myself, is this witness, who may, you know, potentially have something to gain by being a witness, is this a credible witness? And I will tell you, you know, I have had multi-million-dollar cases, bigger cases than that, where essentially during settlement negotiations, right, the other side, I've been on both sides, where I've said to the other side, or the other side has said to me, like, yeah, we just think, like, our witness is going to look better than your guy, or, you know, I've said, I mean, my guy's going to come off great in front of the jury, and your guy is going to come off self-serving. There's a little bit of a, like, kind of gut feeling to it. What I would say with Parnas is, it is, contrast Parnas, right? Here's somebody who's a mediocre witness, right? Gordon Sondland, right? We all saw that during the House investigation. Here was somebody who, I think, the average person looks at Sondland and says, yeah, he's probably telling the truth about all of this stuff.
The third time he's probably telling the truth.
Right. Well, exactly. As Sean Patrick Maloney was just, you know, was great. We appreciate your help, but, you know, we also remember what it took to get you here. And that's because Sondland hasn't really given us a good story as to when he decided to turn and save his skin. Right, Sondland would be a better witness if he could be persuaded to say, look, man, like, I'm just a businessman. I gave a ton of money to Trump, and I wanted to buy an ambassadorship because I thought that would be cool. And I got there, and I was in over my head. And at some point, it was just too much, man. And now, like, yeah, I regret it. And God, like, you know, I didn't want to sell out our country to the Russians. Right. Like, if Sondland could say that, right, that would make him a better witness. But he can't say that because he's not there yet. But we all know that that's kind of where he is. Right. I mean, you know, I'm psychoanalyzing. Right. What's Parnas's story? Because I will tell you, right, we've heard what Rudy Giuliani's story about Parnas's story. Like, the other side's characterization of Parnas is, this is a criminal who's facing charges, who will literally say anything you want him to say if you put him in front of Rachel Maddow.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Parnas can't come out and say, look, I'm a mobbed up guy. I'm the muscle man. I'm the one who goes in and makes threats. And then I hand it off to the bag man who goes in with the, you know, he can't. Do that.
That's what he is. Yeah.
But that's precisely what he is. He's Rocky Balboa in the beginning of Rocky. That's what he does.
That is an excellent callback. There is a way in which you could get him to do that, right? The way in which you could get him to do that would be to grant him complete immunity, right? To give him a non-prosecution agreement. Well, I guess it would now be a plea deal, you know, to 0 months on the existing crimes, right? Like, if you could assure Parnas that anything he said wasn't going to be used against him in subsequent prosecutions, then yeah, he would then get up and give that the kind of mafia informant testimony.
Yeah, but we're at a point where the Southern District of New York is going to have to make that offer, and that's Bill Barr. And I just don't see that happening because I don't think the Congress can offer him that kind of immunity. So, you know, here we are. And I guess, like you said, we'll find out. So it's just hard to say. I'm, you know, like I said, I'm waiting for an indictment or for Berman to resign, but for Giuliani. But, you know, here we are, and I think despite everything and all the nuances that we can get in the weeds and we could talk about this for hours, I think the point here is that we just don't have faith in the independence of the Department of Justice at this point in our history. And that's the real sad part.
Yeah, that I think that's, I love that as sort of a takeaway. And I don't want to obscure, I mean, I want to kind of parse that into two components, right? Number one, the fact that you and I are saying that on a serious, sober news podcast in 2020 is and should be terrifying. And then number two, but that also shouldn't obscure the fact that that we do still have like real uncertainties here, right? Like, I don't know what Parnas actually has and what it's going to take to get it, right? Like, I have a ton of questions about like, why all of a sudden, you know, when the House Intelligence Committee subpoenaed his records in December, why all of a sudden he produced this videotape yesterday or 2 days ago, right? Like, that's a little disconcerting to me. So, you know, it our institutions are broken, and it will be the task of the next president to try and rebuild them. But we also, and like, one of the worst aspects about that is it means that there are things that we don't know, and like, that drives me crazy. So.
Yeah, and we may never know it. All right. Well, thank you so much. Everybody, please check out the Opening Arguments podcast if you don't already. I have a feeling that you listen to it if you're listening to this. And Andrew Torres, real life lawyer, host of Opening Arguments, thank you so much for coming on Mueller, She Wrote.
Oh, AG, thanks for having me anytime.
All right, guys, that's our show. Thank you so much. I was by myself today. I miss Jordan. I miss Mandy, but they'll be back. And I hope that you had a wonderful time. I don't really have any final thoughts other than thank you so much for all your support. And we really do appreciate you guys and especially our patrons. Thank you so much. If you're not a patron, so you can subscribe for free wherever you get your podcast. It would really mean a lot to us. We love it when we outchart Hannity. That's always fun. And I guess that's it. Become a patron if you want. Little as $3 a month, and you'll become a patron of both our podcasts, this one and the Daily Beans. You'll get the Daily Beans ad-free and early, the night before it comes out to the public, and all sorts of great gifts and newsletter and my personal notes and just all sorts of great benefits. And we're going to have a video link up in here soon, too, that you'll get if you're a patron. So that's it. Please take care of yourselves and take care of each other. I've been AG, and this is Mueller, She Wrote. Mueller, She Wrote is executive produced and directed by AG and Jordan Coburn, with engineering and editing by Mackenzie Mazzell and Starburns Industries. Our marketing manager, production and social media direction is by Amanda Reeder. Fact-checking and research by AG, Jordan Coburn, and Amanda Reeder, and our knowledgeable listeners. Our web design and branding are by Joel Reeder with Moxie Design Studios, and our website is MuellerSheWrote.com.
Season 4 of How We Win is here.
For the past 4 years, we've been making history in critical elections all over the country. And last year, we made history again by expanding our majority in the Senate, beating election-denying Republicans in crucial state House races, and fighting back a non-existent red wave.
But the MAGA Republicans who plotted and pardoned the attempted overthrow of our government now control the House, thanks to gerrymandered maps and repressive anti-voter laws. And the chaotic spectacle we've already seen shows us just how far they will go to seize power, dismantle our government, and take away our freedoms.
So the official podcast of The Persistence is back with season 4. There's so much more important work ahead of us to fight for equity, justice, and our very democracy itself. We'll take you behind the lines and inside the rooms where it happens, with strategy and inspiration from progressive changemakers all over the country.
And we'll dig deep into the weekly news that matters most and what you can do about it with messaging and communications expert, co-founder of Way to Win, and our new co-host, Jennifer Fernandez Ancona.
So join Steve and I every Wednesday for your weekly dose of inspiration, action, and hope.
I'm Steve Pearson.
And I'm Jennifer Fernandez Ancona.
And this is How We Win.
MSW Media.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.